Celebrating the written word, this is The County Writes, The County Reads, with Lynn Pickering on 99.3 County FM.
Welcome to the show. Although recent February days have been fairly mild, that hasn't stopped Christine Renaud from curling up with a good book. She'll be along a little later with her monthly book report. But first, last Wednesday, Macaulay Heritage Park featured Jennifer DeBruin, UE, as a guest speaker to mark Heritage Week and to launch anniversary commemorations for Prince Edward County's 225th at the county museums throughout 2017. DeBruin is an author, a public speaker, and descendant of United Empire Loyalists. She gave a talk and audiovisual presentation entitled, A Trip of 230 Plus Years, My Journey Back to the Mohawk Valley. Her books are all, as she refers to them, fact-based fiction. They include A Walk with Mary, Daughter of Conflict, and Shadows in the Tree. I sat down with Jennifer at Macaulay Museum following her presentation to talk about Shadows in the Tree. It's the story of Maria Katrina Amer and her perilous flight from her farm in New York to sanctuary in Quebec. Anne Heathcote reads an excerpt. It is May 1780.
The rap on the door makes me jump. Ruby begins to whimper, but I do not move to comfort her, for our time here has come to an end, and we are most instantaneously being set adrift in life. I open the door and am met by a most fearsome sight. A tall man, covered in blood, towers over me. He pushes his way in, closing the door quickly behind him. I am to gather you and the children to be set upon the trail where you will be met by a guide. We must away at once. He does not wear a uniform, but his message rings true to Peter's words in his letter of but a day ago. Matthias, come now, I urge, as he stands in shocked disbelief of what he is seeing, unable to move. As the man gathers the little ones, roughly picking up Ruby and pulling Matthias by the hand so that he might follow, I pick up Jacob, who has run and hidden behind my skirt. Grabbing the bundle I have prepared, I am ready to leave. You cannot take that with you, for we travel fast. Yet I must, for we will have no means of survival should I not be permitted to take it along. Mrs. Emer, you and your children will not survive if you do. At the sound of my name, the true gravity of the situation is made real. I have to trust that this man, a stranger to us, is our friend sent by Sir John, sent by my beloved to aid in our escape to freedom from this ill-fated place. With no time for one last look at our home, we pass under my tree and away into the dark of night. In a state of alertness I have never experienced, I am suddenly aware of the many sounds, sights, and smells that at one time would have been unknown to me and confusing, but are now revealed in clear, horrifying detail. We stumble upon the frost-covered ground, blinded by the darkness as no light is cast by the sliver of moon that hangs above us. Yet our guide does not hesitate in his step or speed. I hold on to Matthias's hand now, and he to Ruby's, as she has been set down, and we move as one to ensure we do not fall behind, instinctively knowing that there would be no hope for us if this were to happen. At our backs, the screams and cries for mercy carry clearly upon the winds. A mix of human and animal suffering, both equally wretched, both equally doomed, grow as the evil sweeps over the town, engulfing it in flames and death. The war cries echo, seeming to surround us. It is known that Sir John has had the aid of his Iroquois allies at his side, yet it still alarms me. Familiar but equally menacing, voices yell words of retribution, and I know these to be Sir John's men laying siege to our once peaceful town. Ascending the hilltop, which, once crested, will dampen the sickening sounds and spare us the sight of the destruction, I turn back and look down upon the valley where once we lived. Glowing upon the horizon, the barns and homesteads burn, casting light upon the souls of men and animals running in all directions, a scene of chaos signaling the end of this world. Smelling not the fresh air of spring, but the choking smoke of ruin, I step away from what was and look away into the darkness ahead of us. Here, you must follow the path until you are met by your guide. This unknown man is lacking any emotion and barks his order as though we are but soldiers who will understand how to do as he asks. Standing in the obscurity of the forest we have entered, I cannot see his face and only know to follow in listening for his footsteps upon our path. And should it not be our guide we meet, what then? Then, my dear Mrs. Emer, is not something you will need to worry about. In an instant, I feel him move past me, walking back along the path whence we came. As he crests the hill, I see his figure straight and tall. He ominously looks back at us for the briefest moment, the glow of the distant inferno casting a soft light upon his face. I can see the pity and doubt in his eyes. Then, turning, he steps off and is gone.
That was Anne Heathcote reading from Shadows in the Tree by Jennifer De Bruin. Welcome to the County Writes, the County Reads.
Thank you.
In that scene, Maria Katrina is leaving her home. It's May 1780. She's pregnant. There's three young children. But I'd like to go back before that rap on the door. Mm-hmm. And can you explain why her husband Peter has left and who Sir John is?
Sure, no problem. So Maria Katrina, she's living on the homestead, and like many women, because of having young children and being pregnant or infirmed in some way, so she would have been typical of women of that era, in which the men had to flee impending arrest. So Peter and his brothers were marked as traitors to the rebel cause or the American cause, and so they had to flee very quickly. Well, you couldn't do that with very young children in tow, and of course with a wife who's pregnant. So, she's left on the homestead to kind of hopefully be there when they're eventually rescued by loyalist regiments who will again sweep through, or they'll be having a guide show up to take them north. So, now the regiments, of course, to connect Sir John Johnson, was the son of Sir William Johnson, who had originally brought many of these individuals over to the colonies. My ancestors were refugees from the European wars, and so they were farming the land of Sir William Johnson. And when he died in 1774, his son succeeded him. Sir John had already fled to Canada in the previous years in 1776 and had raised the King's Royal Regiment of New York. And so they were part of the warring parties that were coming back in to rescue loyalists and, of course, to fight to win back the land that they were losing to the American cause. So he was sort of the leader in the sense of my ancestors of the Mohawk Valley.
And when they're leaving, they're hearing the battle that's going on behind them. The farms were burned, the animals were burned,
yes.
The crops and the houses, and they often burned them themselves.
Right.
Can you explain why they did that?
So the whole point was so the Continental Army, obviously the Americans, were sweeping through, and they would take the food stores that they would need for their use, and beyond that, they didn't want the Loyalist families to be able to continue to survive in the area, and so that's why they would burn everything that they didn't need themselves and would make sure that the Loyalist families couldn't stay. Now, having said that, war is always this way. As the Loyalist regiments, the King's Royal Regiment of New York, would sweep through, they would do the same thing to the Patriot families, and so they would make sure that they couldn't stay. And so it just becomes, a contest as to who's going to leave first and who can push out the most people. Mm-hmm. Basically, the whole goal was to leave people destitute once you had what you needed for your army or your regiment.
One of the neighbors was tarred and feathered. That was a common punishment at that time.
In the colonies, it was a common punishment for anybody who sort of went against something. So during the American Revolution, it was still being done, but it had been done from the earliest times of probably in Europe they were doing it as well. So
you mentioned they were already refugees when they arrived in the States. Can you tell me their origins?
So my ancestors, who I wrote about in the book, are German Palatines. They're from a western part of Germany in the Palatinate. And, of course, there was the religious wars there. And so they were fleeing religious persecution, as many people who made their way to the colonies would have. They were given passage. Originally, it was supposed to be to England. Once they arrived in England in ships, Queen Anne had given them passage to that point, they realized that the people in England did not want refugees in their midst, and so they were afraid they were going to take their jobs and take away opportunity. So Queen Anne arranged to have them sent either to Ireland in some cases, in the cases of my ancestors, to the colonies. 7 years of service was expected, though, for your passage. And so these families, being tradespeople and already being destitute, were sent inland to what was the western frontier of the Mohawk Valley to farm. Whether they were farmers or not in their previous life, a lot of them were coopers or blacksmith, or you did what was required of you to pay off this debt. And so, yeah, so they were starting over again, and you couldn't really start over for 7 years. So it's quite a trying time for them.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to 1780, when Maria Katrina is leaving, many of the men were killed or imprisoned, but the women were also imprisoned as well. I just want to read this little quote from the book. "One by one, our friends and neighbors of German descent were sent to the Tory prisons for imagined and assumed sympathies. Then, as Ezekiel was closing down his shop for the day, for he is a blacksmith, he was snatched away. I was not able to see him beforehand and only heard of his imprisonment when they came to my door to inform me that we were no longer welcome and must leave at once. When I asked if I might bid him goodbye, they laughed at me and said, 'Not unless you are a good swimmer.' They had sent him to the Fleet Prison." That's the first time I'd heard of the Fleet Prison. Can you just describe that?
I hadn't heard until I did the research, but apparently this was an old imprisonment-type system where they would essentially have these decrepit ships. They would take everything out of them, and they would let people linger in the ships. So they would be fed, but it would be very poor quality food. Obviously, there would be damp, and there would be disease. So if you can just imagine the big old warships hollowed out, and the worst of the worst, you know, sort of on their last leg, that's what a fleet prison was. Now, as much as, you know, the Americans were using it, so were the British. So there was fleet prisons on both sides. I believe that one is in reference to the one at Fishkill, New York. And so there was a fleet prison there. Mm.
You're listening to The County Writes, The County Reads. My guest is Jennifer De Bruin, author of Shadows in the Tree. When we come back, Maria Katrina and her children face death as they travel through the forest on their way to sanctuary in Quebec. Stay with 99.3 County FM, the voice of the county.